Okay, let's try to give our attention to Roseanne, and thank you, Roseanne, for stepping up. Sarah was, we had Sarah's schedule, but events came along that wouldn't allow that, so thank you, Roseanne.
So, if you came hoping to hear my funny and forthright daughter-in-law, you're going to be disappointed. But I'm glad to have the opportunity to speak because it gives me a chance to tell you how thankful I am for how the Women's Bible Study has gone this fall. I feel like the quality of the talks has been excellent. Everyone has bit the bullet and done exegesis. And it's fine if you are doing a talk and you want to do something devotional, but we are a Women's Bible Study, so we do want to try to come up to the plate and study the Bible. Sue Henderson told me about the seminar that she went to at the Frequency Conference, and it was on women in the church, and someone asked, how can we help women in the church? And the facilitator said, we can, instead of doing fluffy and frilly, frothy things for women in the church, we can give them the tools to study the Bible for themselves. So I have some. I like frilly fluff. I mean, arts and crafts, yeah, cooking classes, I like that kind of stuff. But it is our hope to be giving you the tools to study the Bible by yourself. And so the first way we want to do that is model it for you. But we are also hoping that, you know, you will come up to the plate and say, I think I could do that. So if that's crossing anybody's mind, please do speak to us. So I want to pick up where Ashley was last week and talk about the tools in the backpack. And just to tell you, there's not endless ways to do exegesis, Bible study. There's some tried and true paths. And so let's review some of those. So the first one we want to take out of the backpack is the first one that Ashley took out of the backpack, and that is geography. So let me talk first about geography as elevation. So this book of Mark started at the point, the lowest point. The Jordan River is the river with the lowest elevation in the whole world. So it's not the lowest geographical point, but it's the lowest river. So then it goes up a bit in terms of elevation to Capernaum and Galilee. And then it's gone up a bit more to Caesarea Philippi last week. But this high mountain is the elevation high point of the book. So this is a literal and also the literary high point of the book. So we can also talk about geography as place. And I am going to back up and talk to you a little bit about Caesarea Philippi as place, because I want to connect that to the Transfiguration. So when we talk about, we talk about Philadelphia as place, so we don't really worry about the fact that it's got certain geographical formation or elevation, but we're thinking about its history, or we're thinking of sports teams, or its cheese steaks, something like that. So let me tell you about Caesarea Philippi, which is where Jesus asks Peter who he is. So Caesarea Philippi is where the Jordan starts, and the Jordan comes out of this rock wall, 30 or 40 feet wide, so maybe as wide as this room, and it's literally water from the rock, because there's snow on the top of Mount Hermon, and that snow melts down into a crack in the mountain, and then comes out in this huge river at Caesarea Philippi. And so that's an unusual geographical event, and naturally people appropriated that for their shrines. So back behind this wall there's a cave, and in the cave there's alcoves built, and people would put their idols there. So at the time of Christ, the idols there was a statue of Pan, who was the Greek god who became a man, and there was a statue of Caesar, the man who claimed to be a god. So now you can see that's the place that Jesus had to ask this question. And it was named after Caesarea, Caesar, Caesarea, and Philippi, Philip, who was the Herod, who was Herodias' first husband. And that is why Jesus had to choose that spot to ask his question. And it was a question that had to be asked. Jesus had waited 2.5 years to ask it. And if it has to be asked, and it has to be answered correctly. Because if it's not answered correctly, what would the coming disappointment of the cross mean to them? They wouldn't be equipped to put the puzzle pieces together. They wouldn't be able to interpret to the world, which is what Christ has called them to do, what has happened on Good Friday and Easter. So Jesus' mission to die would serve the cause of justice. God would be available to forgive people, but if nobody could attach that to the person of Christ, what would be the point? How would anybody be saved? So only if they get this question of Christ's identity right can Jesus turn south and go to Judea and Jerusalem to face his death, as he does at the beginning of chapter 10. So Jesus' movement south is a sign that he thinks he's achieved his goal with his disciples, but it doesn't come right away. Chapter 9 is in the way. And in chapter 9, so that brings us to the transfiguration. So another thing that Ashley talked about was Jesus restoring people. So we can think of this trip up to the mountain as Jesus giving them a second chance, a chance to restore. Ashley talked about the second feeding of the 5,000 was, you know, their second chance. And so Jesus narrows it down to 3 and invites them to come apart by themselves, which is what he had promised them back in chapter 6, but it didn't happen. To a high mountain. So let's talk about geography as topography. And we've talked about wilderness, so let's talk about mountains. The wilderness was the haunt, you know, of the wild beasts, and it was home to the demonic. But the mountain was where God was. Abraham went up unto the mountain to sacrifice Isaac, and there he met the ram. God gave the law at Mount Sinai. Elijah's contest with Baal was on Mount Carmel. Elijah hears the still small voice at Mount Horeb. So let's put the geography tool back in the book bag now and see if we can find another tool. But to sum up, geography can be these different things, physical formation, elevation, it could be place. But whatever it is, look for how it supports or discloses the meaning. So the second tool is, anybody want to guess? One of Ashley's tools. Very nice. Repeated words. So this is my beloved son is the voice that they hear on the mountain. And this was both at the baptism and at the crucifixion. So the second one also locates this as the center of the book. And in the first, you are my beloved son, in whom I am well pleased, which happens at the baptism. It's directed to Jesus, and it's not clear that anyone else hears it. But on the mountain, here at the book's high point, this statement is delivered to a community. So another tool to ask is, how is this alike and how different? And so when we look at the Old Testament, men on a mountain and God speaking to them, it's always a man alone and God speaks to him. But now it's a group. Jesus in the center, the leaders of the Old Testament people of God, and the leaders of the church. So the voice says, "You are my beloved son." In the first chapter, it says, "In whom I am well pleased," directed to Jesus. But here it is not "in whom I am well pleased," it is "hear him." And these words are picked up from lots of places, but in the Gospel of Mark, from the first parable, the sower and the seed in chapter 4. And recently, Peter has had trouble hearing. So what comes to me about the hearing is that Jesus has told them to be careful what you hear, because how you listen will affect how much more you get told. If you hear well, you will be given more to hear. And that's my paraphrase of Mark 4, 24 and 25, where Jesus says, "Take heed what you hear. Unto you that hear shall more be given, and he that hath not, from him shall be taken away, even that which he hath. So in Mark 4, Jesus is speaking to the Jewish nation and its leaders. They have the Old Testament. Are they listening to it so that they can receive more? And here on the Mount, we see the relationship to it and to what Peter has just said at Caesarea Philippi. He has been hearing, and now he and his friends are getting more. And Jesus takes them together so that post-resurrection, or even right now, they can verify to each other that this really happened. So we could connect it to what Pam said about Jesus being the master teacher. So we might want to ask ourselves, am I hearing what the Lord is saying to me? So now we want to look at some of the details, and our third tool will be comparing some of those details with other parts of the Bible and asking how they're alike and how different. So we already looked at the mountain as a place where men in the Old Testament met God, alike, a place to meet God. Different, it's not the lone hero meeting God, but a community of believers. So let's look at some of the other details then. Jesus shining as the light shines. Shining was what God did. It was his first creation, light out of darkness. During the plagues, Egypt was dark, but Goshen was not. So when Jesus appears shining in bright apparel, they are seeing God. This is an epiphany, a big word for an appearance of God. And how is that like the Old Testament? Well, in the Old Testament, God did appear, or an angel representing God. Some of those figures seem to be representative gods. It's not always easy to figure out what's going on. And in the Old Testament, God appears, and it's for the purpose of mission. But the most important difference is, I mean, there's a purpose, you know, he didn't just show up to be friends. The most important difference is that those Old Testament appearances are short-lived. For example, the strange wrestler who cripples and renames Jacob, he wants to get away at the break of day. And do we want him to stay around? You know, the angel that incinerates the meal that Gideon prepares for him, do we want him to stay for supper? And the angels that blind the neighbors in Sodom, are they really safe? Are they housebroken? I don't think so. I think when those people leave, that's fine. You can leave now. But this appearance of a figure in shining light and absolutely white clothes, he's been in the back bedroom healing an elderly mother-in-law. He's been asleep at the bottom of the boat. He's let them eat with unwashed hands. He's so tame that Peter feels he is right to educate him on what it means to be the Messiah. So the transfiguration is a necessary response to Peter's lecture. We sing at this time of the year, veiled in flesh the Godhead see. Here at the transfiguration, we see the veil pulled aside. And so far, we've seen the veil pulled aside in things that Jesus does. Ruling the storms, casting out the demons, walking on the waves, feeding thousands. But here he does nothing. The veil is pulled aside on his person. Jesus is the prince who came disguised as the pauper, and here the rags slip and we get a glimpse of the gold, purple, and scarlet. So we can ask, where does this happen in the Old Testament? And the answer is nowhere. Jesus is the first God-man, not Pan, not Caesar, and the last, none other. And this is where we want exegesis to take us. We want all those tools to take us on the height that leads us to Christ. We want to land on the square that says Jesus. You can exegete anything. Shakespeare, Dr. Seuss, the ingredients in mouthwash. But scripture texts need to bring us to Jesus. All right. So where else is another tool is, where else is this talked about in the Bible? And later, when Peter is an old man, one of the accusations against him and the disciples is that they're just making this all up. It's the stuff of myth and legend. May sound familiar. And Peter responds in 1 Peter 1, not with the story of the resurrection or the miracles, but with a retelling of the transfiguration. And the way he tells it in 1 Peter and here in Mark 9, he tells it in such a way that we can see that the transfiguration is an acting out of Psalm 2. Now, Psalm 2 was an enthronement song. It was sung at the coronation of the Old Testament king and also regarded as messianic. It would refer to the enthroning of the Messiah. So Psalm 2 is a ceremonial dialogue in which God says, "Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill." That's where we are. This is God announcing he's installing the king. In other words, the king is not there on his own authority. He's been installed there by God. Then the king who is being installed says, as part of the formal ceremony, "I will proclaim the decree of the Lord." In other words, I'm not making this up on my own. This is the decree of the Lord. "He said to me, 'You are my son. Today I have become your father.'" That is the king accepting the role of authority and kingship. And he's not just anyone. He is the son. So he's the prince. So here we are on the mountain, my holy hill, with the voice from God that quotes Psalm 2. This is Jesus accepting the kingship from God. And now we can see why he says this is the kingdom of God coming with power. So in this scenario, Moses and Elijah are the courtiers that attend the prince, courtiers who have played kingdom parts in bringing judgment and redemption. So we can expect that this king is also going to bring judgment and redemption. And this is a quote from Susan Henrich, professor at Luther Seminary. "Both Moses and Elijah, two figures whose passings were mysterious, were believed by many Jews to be God's precursors of the end times. Because Elijah went bodily into heaven and Moses' grave was never found, these two men of faith were thought to be available for God to send back. God would send them to inform humankind that God's reign was at hand. It is no accident that these two appear with Jesus on the mountain. They discuss that change already prophesied, and as the two messengers disappear into the cloud, the word comes, 'Listen to Jesus, the only one left.'" So now Jesus becomes the divinely chosen precursor of the turn of the age. Again, the focus narrows to just Jesus, the king who brings the kingdom. So let's talk about the cloud. The cloud is another signal of what's happening here. It's an Old Testament trapping of majesty. Mount Sinai, you know, where there's a cloud and thunder and lightning are coming out of it, and the smoke of Isaiah's vision. But it's also a sign of Israel's God. The gods of the nations could be made into little images, you know, that you put in alcoves and caves that could be seen and, if seen, understood, analyzed, and controlled. Israel's God is not available for scrutiny and analysis. But Peter, in response, has not returned into a blithering idiot. This is Susan Henrich again. At the end of Zechariah, the Feast of Booths is described as the time when God would usher in the new age, the day of the Lord. This God-commanded festival kept by Jews for centuries was considered a possible time for God's taking control of God's creation and beginning the age of Shalom. So Peter's question about building booths is neither laughable nor mistaken. Peter is clear that the end times are coming and the Feast of Booths was upon them. Moses, Jesus, and Elijah need not construct their own booths for the celebration. And if this is 6 months before Passover, it could very well have been the time of the Feast of the Booths. So why does Peter use the transfiguration as proof? And Peter was the apostle to the Jews. There's no Jewish tradition of rising from the dead. As you can see from this passage, the beginning and the end, there's confusion about rising from the dead. But there was a clear Jewish tradition of enthronement and Psalm 2. And so as he is the apostle to the Jews and facing the accusation that this is all made up, he can put it into the transfiguration into the Jewish context of enthronement. Okay, so moving on to the next part, which is puzzling. Why does Jesus get mad? Why does Jesus say this kind only comes out by prayer and fasting and then casts it out without prayer and fasting? So let's start with things that we can see clearly. See the men as trees walking and see if we can reach seeing everything clearly. The clearest thing to me is the Father. He gets it. I believe, help my unbelief. He gets that faith is the key and he doesn't have it. We might say he is poor in spirit. So he brings together two strands in the Gospel of Mark. One is the people who are upbraided for unbelief, and the other is the line of people who are desperate. And sometimes the people reproached for unbelief don't get anything from Jesus. Of course, a lot of times they do. But there are also the people who are so desperate that they are driven to beg for Jesus beyond Jesus' rebuff. Jesus rebuffs the Syrophoenician woman because she isn't Jewish. And there's other reasons that people rebuff people. But this man's deficiency, the thing that he doesn't have, this is the essential human condition. Because no matter your race or sex, faith is the one thing we need and the one thing we don't have. And he starts with recognizing his unbelief, which neither the Pharisees, nor who are the traditional leaders, or the disciples, who are the emerging leaders, have been willing to do. So there's lots of turning points in this section. There's Peter seeing Jesus as the Christ. There's the high point on the mountain. There's chapter 10. Jesus is beginning to take the journey south to Jerusalem. Lots of turning points. But this man, to me, is in the middle of it all, the turning point between someone who can combine unbelief in this and desperate need, cries out to Jesus for help. Another thing that seems clear is that the disciples come off the mountain wondering what rising from the dead means. And it seems that some of what plays out in this exorcism is a bit of role play about what it is to rise from the dead. Again, Jesus is the master teacher. He takes them, he's one dead, and Jesus takes him by the hand and lifts him up, and he arose. So what is Jesus saying? I think he is saying to his disciples, there is a price to pay, and you aren't willing to pay it. With that, this kind only comes out with prayer and fasting. So let's talk about that in the context of these stories. The two stories of Jesus' power, the stories of the transfiguration and the healing, are bracketed by Jesus talking about the price he is going to pay. And make no mistake, he's telling them they too will have a price to pay. At both the feedings of the multitudes, Jesus has challenged them to do the feeding. Was he challenging them to do the miracle? Or was he challenging them to pay the price in terms they could pay, namely get a letter of credit from someone and going into debt for 8 months of wages? So likewise here, Jesus must be talking about a life of prayer and fasting, a life of paying the price of going beyond ordinary prayer, a life of determining to best the demonic no matter what it takes. And the relation of all this to unbelief is only if you've seen Jesus by faith on the top of that mountain, no other one like that, will you have the faith to do the self-denial. You work yourself up to the self-denial. You don't work yourself up to faith. You see Jesus. So this section ends by Jesus once again predicting his death, but it's a bit different this time. In Mark 8, he's emphasized the rejection and names the rejectors. And here he skips that part and emphasizes this being killed and rising again. And once again, they don't understand, but at least this time they are silent. So I think we can see this as progress. They can't see, but at least they can see that there's something there to see. So let me close by saying this. You know, we all are involved in enthronement ceremonies. Most of the time I would like to enthrone myself, have everybody look at me and everybody else do the hard work. But Jesus is calling us to the enthronement ceremony of the one and only King who will empower us to do the hard work. So let's pray.